Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings. Let it rise.
Four minutes after the hour, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. Good luck with that, because that's a lot of work. That's I think that's the whole idea, that we're supposed to put the same energy we have into meeting our neighbor's needs as we do our own. That's not going to happen. I don't think, anyway, not in this life. So anyway, it's an ambitious thought, but you have to be mindful to love your neighbor, because maybe you don't like your neighbor, but that's something you got to work on. All right, here's something I found fascinating in Miami, Florida. A lawyer's pants catches on fire during an arson trial. I can't make this up. The phrase liar, liar, pants on fire is taking on a literal meaning when a lawyer's pants started burning in a Florida courtroom. Defense attorney Stephen Gutierrez's pants started smoking while he was defending an arson suspect in Miami-Dade County Court. Gutierrez told NBC News he began to feel heat coming from his pocket when he had several e-cigarette batteries. While arguing his client's car had spontaneously combusted, his pants did the same thing. Oh, no further questions, Your Honor. That's kind of funny. Here's something I found interesting. There was a competition in the state with Minnesota lawmakers. Wednesday was the annual hot dish off between members of the Minnesota congressional delegation. The goal of the cooking competition is to promote unity among the state's lawmakers. Representative Colin Peterson won the competition for his right to bear arms hot dish. The recipe calls for a pound and a half of lean bear meat. Ha! I think I'll pass on that one. The Rochester Meat Company, thousands of pounds of pork sausage from the Rochester Meat Company has been recalled, which is no surprise because every time I eat pork sausage, it is also recalled. Fill in the blank on that one. Okay. This was interesting. In England, a British photographer's curiosity is being credited with finding some history. The photographer followed a rabbit hole in a farm on a field in England, which led him to a cave and tunnels said to be used by the Knights Templars during the Middle Ages. The photographer told the BBC that what appears to be an underground temple is in amazing condition for its age. The Knights Templars were associated with the Crusades before being dissolved. The photographer also found some beef jerky on the table, which he said was still very tasty.
And also about 700 years old?
At least that old. At least. All right. We've got a great second hour coming up here this morning on Faith Radio. We're going to talk to Rebecca Lyons. We had a chance to talk to her husband, Gabe Lyons. That is one dynamic duo of a couple. They have a lot of interesting things to say. She says, let's stop fearing. Let's just let's be free. Let's just, not God will make us free, but God says we are free. Let's live who we are. In that conversation coming up just in a few minutes after the news. It's 7 minutes after. I hope your Friday's starting off in the right way, because this weekend, remember, coming up on Saturday at 2 in the morning, you turn the clock ahead. So Monday morning is going to, it's going to be a tough one. All right, be back in a minute. Welcome back to Faith Radio. Bill Arnold here. I am working on a blog this week called My Week with the Lyons, because I also spoke to Gabe Lyons, and now I get a chance to talk to Rebecca Lyons. And how odd is this, that Rebecca Lyons spells her name Rebecca the same way Rebecca Maxwell at the board spells her name. This, is this coincidence or is this divine appointment? I don't know.
Well, I think it's the best way to spell it, so we'll have to ask Rebecca what she thinks.
Well, we will ask her that. She's written a book called You Are Free, Be Who You Already Are. And I think most of us sooner or later will experience a moment when everything in our life changes and we realize that life really doesn't look the way we expected it to or dreamed or what we dreamed it would be. So we're going to talk to her. Welcome to the program, Rebecca Lyons.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I love it. So a question you ask is, do you remember a moment you felt completely free? That's a huge question.
Yes.
That's a head scratcher.
What
races to my mind is I'm 13 years old and I'm praying to receive Christ. And I thought, I felt a way I've never felt before in my life, and I'll never forget that feeling.
Wow. Yeah. It requires all of us to pause for a moment, right?
It does.
Especially as adults, when we're running hard and fast after the things that, you know, we want to serve God and follow Him and please Him. And I think sometimes we forget that first love, where it began and what propelled this zeal in the first place.
Yeah, it was my moment of supreme freeness. Now your turn. You go ahead.
You know, for me, it was when I was younger. Probably I accepted Christ at 5. And I believed right in that moment that Jesus was the Son of God, that he died on the cross, he rose again, he covered my sins. I believed that all of it was true, and I wanted, and I also didn't want to go to hell, to be fair. I'm not sure how many five-year-olds would. And so there was this this sense of believing it and receiving it, and but yet only really entering what freedom in relationship meant, because at that age I didn't really know what I was being saved from, beyond the fact that, you know, I might tell a lie or sneak a cookie, but what was I actually being invited into? And that's where it started to, the freedom for me became this relationship, this sense of His nearness. And so for me it would be in creation, when I was alone with God in the secret place. And I write a little bit in the book about riding my bike, my 10 feet around my neighborhood at dusk, and my parents call us all in. It's getting dark, but I would linger. There was this sense of God's nearness when all was kind of hushed and reverent, and the wind kind of blowing in the trees. And I don't know, even then as a small child, I knew that He was there, and I knew that I was invited into this communion with Him, even though I wouldn't have known exactly how to do that or what that was supposed to look like. I just felt His nearness in a way that I could kind of tangibly talk to Him and engage Him and have this ongoing dialogue with Him.
That's pretty real. I mean, you remember that and describe it with a beautiful simplicity. And I can almost picture you on that summer night lingering, not going back home, on your bike, sensing God's presence. That's really a sweet moment.
Yeah. It's a gift, right? That He
yes.
shows Himself in a way, in with childlike faith, that just says, if you're who you say you are, you created all this creation and nature around us, then you're here. Like, you're here in the midst of our everyday lives, and can we invite you into that?
Mm-hmm.
And as children, we have an active imagination. It's easier for us to almost comprehend that than it is for adults.
Rebecca, how do we overcome the exhaustion, and you talk about this in your book, of meeting other people's expectations?
Well, like I, you know, growing up, I realized while I felt free in that secret place, and then I would step into church or school or, you know, even just peer relationships, there was always an expectation put on my faith, you know, to where you wanted to, and to be fair, you know, I'm the firstborn of three girls. I have an older brother who's adopted, but I kind of took on that personality as the achiever, the one who wanted to accomplish things, to please people. So I leaned into striving and perfectionism. And so that's where the rat race began. It wasn't when I was alone with God. It was when I was trying to represent God to everyone else. I think sometimes we get caught up in doing big things for God, and we forget that we're actually supposed to receive small things from God.
Mm-hmm.
First, always.
Yeah. If we're going to try to abide in God's presence, we're going to maybe have to release some stress and some anxiety to find that peace that's underneath it all. But what about when we have past disappointments, times when our heart has been broken and our dreams haven't been met, and we stay stuck there? Then what?
Well, I talk about this in my chapter, Free to Grieve. It's all about, you know, confession is the gateway to freedom, and I learned this really only in the last several years, and I write this freedom story or freedom journey, and it always began with confession. And confession we think of as a repentance of our sin, but actually it begins there, but it ends in declaration. It's almost just an invitation to say, I'm sorry, you know, like my heart is broken, I feel like you're distant. It's just to begin having a conversation with God. Like, prayer is this dialogue. And so it takes these past disappointments or brokenhearted wounds or for us to acknowledge them, bring them to the surface, literally name them, release them with our words, and lay them at his feet and say, can you heal this broken heart? Like, I'm tired of carrying this alone or burying it because the pain's too great. Can you actually remove the pain? Can you absorb the pain onto yourself like you did on the cross, like, and bring comfort? And if we cannot grieve, we cannot be comforted. And so sometimes we're walking around crippled, carrying a wound from a decade ago or 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago simply because we don't feel permission to let it out. And yet the very letting it out and the confession is where the healing begins.
Yeah, Rebecca, is it possible one of the things that's always helpful is to review our position of who God is and who we are? Let's just review who we are positionally so we can understand that God has nothing but our best interest in mind and is going to use every opportunity he can to grow us and make us into who he wants us to be.
Yeah, I'm reminded of this in Galatians. That's the book on freedom, and it's not written to those outside the church. It's written to the church, and what
yes.
he says in Galatians 3 is he's like, you're no longer fearful slaves because I've made you mine. You're sons and daughters now. You, because of Christ, before Christ, you were slaves, but because of Christ, you're mine, and you are freely given the righteousness of Christ, like everything that Christ offered of himself on the cross, you receive in Hebrews 10. And so all of a sudden, we're like, wait a minute, that's too much. Like, how could you love us with that kind of kindness and that love? He's like, because I've made you mine. You're now co-heirs with Christ, and this is how I see you.
Mm-hmm.
So we see our pain and our brokenness, and God says, no, what I see is wholeness and redemption and righteousness when I look at you because of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, we're like, we feel unworthy, but that's where I kind of broke. I've been a believer for, you know, now 35-plus years, and it only in the last 7 years that I start to comprehend the kind of love that says, I see your sins no more. I will never again remember your lawless acts. I will write my laws on your minds and bind them on your heart. Because of Christ, you are mine.
Yeah. I'm talking to Rebecca Lyons, who's totally awesome, by the way. And she's written a book called You Are Free. Be Who You Already Are. We'll take a break. When we come back, more with Rebecca Lyons. This is Faith Radio. Bill Arnold here. Be right back. Welcome back to the show. Here's a great line, Rebecca, from your book that says, Christ doesn't say you can be or may be or will be free. He says you are free. What a great line. Dare you believe
you know,
this?
I get, you know, the idea of this here is in Revelation 12:11. It says, the enemy is bound by two things in our lives. The strongholds in our lives are bound by two things, and it's Christ's blood and our testimony. And I think sometimes Jesus looks at the church and he says, hey guys, I did my part. Where are you going to pick up and walk in the freedom that's already been given to you? And so it's not like this condemnation or frustration. It's more just like we stand in a metaphorical jail cell. There's no door, there's no lock, there's no key, and yet we're holding on to the bars because we're so afraid that it's not true, that we will fall and flatline on our face. And Jesus doesn't say you're not going to suffer. He's like, but you're actually, because you're mine, you even share in the resurrection, you share in the suffering, but know that I have overcome the world. I will give you everything you need. Just walk with me arm in arm like in Eden, you know, like the way it was intended, this communion with God from the very beginning. And so I think this invitation of freedom is like Christ has already done the work. The perfect law has set us free from the power of sin and death, sin that leads to death in our lives. So if we believe that, then we say, okay, then whatever pain is in my life right now, depression, anxiety, brokenness of relationship, resentment, bitterness, then I pray the cross of Christ over this and receive the healing that he offers. And then we ask for his help to walk into that, you know? But we have to begin by just acknowledging the pain and saying, I want to invite you into the middle of this mess so you can show me the freedom that you've already given me.
Okay. Let's say there's listeners who call themselves perfectionists. Never be my problem. But we've got self-condemnation, and we get up every day and we beat ourselves, we whoop ourselves. How do we start getting away from that and stepping into this freedom that you talk about, where we can start discovering kind of a new freedom that we're not used to?
Well, part of it's understanding the difference between conviction and condemnation. And if we're not careful, they sound similar, right? Conviction says, I have sinned. I have done something wrong. Condemnation says, I am something wrong. And so it begins this self-loathing that the enemy just has a heyday with. He wants us to wake up feeling like despair, which means despair is the belief that we will never change, that the sin, the power of sin and death is stronger than the cross and the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So we have nothing to hope for, right? But if we have the ordered truth, the truth says, yes, sin will still come against you. The prince of the earth will still shoot the fiery dart in your vulnerable spot on your body. He's aware, and he knows what will take you out or will tempt you to be taken out. And so he'll keep going back again and again and again. And I think now it's for us as believers to be armored to know how to respond to that attack and go, actually, this is a lie. This isn't truth. In Christ, I am not all these things. And a lot of times we label ourselves by our brokenness and our wounds instead of saying, this is not who I am. I'm a son and a daughter of the King, who is entrusted with birthright gifts and who has set me free.
Okay, great answer. Now I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if I'll ask this well, and it might be confusing, but is there a difference between having freedom that God wants us to have and then managing pain from a past experience, which might be so difficult that you have to figure out a way to live with this for the rest of your life?
Yes, because I think meaning comes from three things. It's from your, this is work of Viktor Frankl. It's meaning, and this is informed by his faith, but meaning comes in your love and your work and your bravery and suffering. And I do think sometimes we think as believers, we share in the resurrection, but not the suffering. But Jesus was a man of sorrow, well acquainted with grief, and with freedom comes great responsibility. And so freedom doesn't mean like you live a pain-free life and you get to just do whatever you want. Freedom is always for the betterment of others. And so what I've learned through my own suffering, you know, my story is one of anxiety and depression. But what I've learned, even in the rescue moments of that, in the relief and the deliverance moments of that, it doesn't mean that I'm never tempted to fear. To be, you know, anxiety became my fancy word for fear. And there are still seasons, even now, where I'll be gripped in fear or I'll wake up and feeling in torment. And in those moments, I think James 1 says, count it joy when you face trials. Not because it's the trial, but what the trial does is it continues to cause you to cry out for his strength and not your own, for his rescue and not your own. And really, ultimately, God's after our heart. What he wants more than anything is our intimacy and union with him. And so the suffering starts to pale. It starts to become backseat. It starts to become not the focus. The focus is the relationship and the dependence on him. And as we walk through that, we'll find that our perspective will shift. And the suffering, like I can say now, it's been a gift in the way that it's given me empathy for the person I'm praying with. It helps me go, you're not alone. We all, you know, we're still broken, in desperate need of a Savior. We still need him every day, but how can we stir one another to looking to that instead of focusing on what hasn't happened yet?
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, in your fellowship circles and speaking circles, are you coming across a lot of people who, women in particular, that have felt like they're so tired and wounded from trying that they've given up and they're really burned out?
Yes. But I also think, you know, faith, our measure of faith isn't always dependent on us. You know, it says God is the author and perfecter of our faith, and he'll actually use moments, you know, he'll use the Spirit of the living God to stir something in us that has grown dormant, that has grown complacent, that has grown discouraged and defeated and weary. And I have encountered so many women, especially in the last month, who are starting to read these words or who are starting to kind of process these questions that they have tabled for literally decades, that there's something, you know, God appoints a word in season. And we can never negate the fact that he might plant something, a verse, it all of a sudden brings us to our knees, because repentance happens in a moment. It's something that can erase and redeem and restore what's been lost for years and years and years. And I believe that God is an active God, and he woos us to his heart, and he gets our attention, and he draws us to himself right exactly in the perfect moment. And so it's never too late. Mm-hmm. Never too late to have a fresh hope.
So we've got about 30 seconds left, but I also want to say your book says you can confess to God your desire to grieve. So if you've got something you've carried for a long, long time, you can go there and say, I need to confess my desire, but also ask God to comfort you even in your mourning.
Yeah. Yep.
So
absolutely.
That sounds like a great, You Are Free is the name of the book, Be Who You Already Are. I love that. Thanks, Rebecca, so much for being on the show. And say hi to Gabe for me. And have a great
I
week.
I will.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks. We'll take a short break and be right back. Three minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical. He's a fun guy to talk to. We'll be back in just a minute. Thirty-seven minutes after the hour. Good morning. Thanks for being with us this morning on Faith Radio. Bill Arnold here. Fridays, on occasion, I get to talk to Chris Martin. TheMillennialEvangelical.com is where you go to find his work and his writing and his blogging. And we're going to talk today a little bit about being raised in a two-parent interfaith home, which is going to be interesting. Chris, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I love the idea of the two interfaith home conversation. I always think of a joke that makes me laugh, which was Bill Maher, who's, I'm not a fan necessarily of his, but I do like some of his comedy. Because he said my father was Jewish and my mother was Catholic growing up, interfaith home. And he said I'd go to confession saying, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I think you know my attorney, Mr. Cohen.
Nice. Very nice.
But it is difficult for kids being raised in an interfaith home. And how are they coming out of these? What's happening?
Well, the Pew data that I looked at, there wasn't a ton of information on how they were coming out, necessarily them believing. However, what was most interesting to me was, you know, America's generally considered, has always kind of been considered a predominantly Christian nation, largely because our founders believed in a sort of monotheistic, deistic faith that for some maybe was a Christian faith, and for some maybe Christian light or some version of Christianity that today we wouldn't even call Christianity, having Thomas Jefferson cutting out all the supernatural things from his Bible, etc. So Americans often kind of been considered a Protestant Christian nation, and eventually with immigrants, especially like Irish immigrants, it became even more of a Catholic nation. So there's some data released back in October from the Pew Research Center, which is where I find a lot of my data on millennials. They seem to be doing the most research on millennials. And this study that they did wasn't on millennials specifically. It was on people of all generations in America. However, they broke it, some of the data out by generation. And what was most interesting to me about this was, and this is in two-parent homes. When you start looking at single-parent homes, the numbers get a little bit more cloudy. But in two-parent homes, there's a higher percentage of millennials growing up with two parents of different faiths than two parents who are Protestant, both Protestant, which is incredible. It's really interesting because, I mean, like baby boomers, for instance, those born between 1946 and 1964, roughly, only 19% of them grew up in a home with two parents of different faiths versus 27% for millennials. So that's an 8% difference. Mm-hmm. And then on the Protestant number, boomers, 40% of boomers grew up in a home with two Protestant parents versus 24 of millennials. That's a 16% difference.
Wow, that's a significant jump.
Huge.
Decline,
So it's really interesting. I think it just shows the increasing diversity, not just racially, obviously here, faith, religious diversity in America. And a significant percentage of millennials are growing up in a home with at least one religiously affiliated, one religiously unaffiliated parent, 12% of Americans. But that number, I believe, is higher for millennials.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, let's see. 15% of millennials. So millennials are actually 3% higher than the national average growing up with one religiously affiliated parent and one religiously unaffiliated parent.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the data was really interesting. It came out back in October. I just haven't had the time to dig into it until now. So it's really kind of interesting how the picture of faith in the home is kind of changing in America.
Mm-hmm. Chris, does data make your head explode every once in a while?
Sometimes. Yeah. You know, I always joke. I was just talking to someone about doing a report on some data for a project they kind of wanted me to help with. And I joked, though seriously, that statistics is the only kind of math I've ever liked. It's the only math I comfortably got an A in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else was a fight. So I actually kind of like stats. They're interesting because it's at least practical, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a stat for you. 95% of all people think there is the existence of God, believe there is an existence of God. 75% believe there's no such thing as absolute truth. How about that conflict?
Yeah, that is really interesting. I think it's not surprising because God can be a really kind of amorphous blob for a lot of people who say they believe in God. A lot of people say they believe in God to cover their bases. I'm doing research. I have a book manuscript due in June kind of on the same subject of my blog, and I'm doing a lot of research into Christian Smith.
We might Notre Dame. Either, yeah. Okay.
Brilliant guy.
Mm-hmm. And who is that? Christian Smith?
Christian Smith is a sociologist at Notre Dame.
Okay.
And he has a ton of great research on young people and faith. One of his books is called Soul Searching. In that book, he coined the term moralistic therapeutic deism, which if you're in the kind of the religious space, you may have heard from time to time. It's the basic idea that young people – which when he did the study, he was studying like high schoolers, mm-hmm. but it was a number of years ago. So he was born around late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And they largely believe in a God that isn't Christian, but is a God and is all powerful over everything and tends to make life easier if you do good things and make life harder if you do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like this fusion of like karma and a monotheistic Christian kind of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so your stat about 95% of people believe in God, but 75% believe in
no absolute truths.
Correct. That's not surprising.
Yeah.
Because a significant amount of young people I know, the generation millennials I study, that is most certainly the case.
Okay. I really want to get into this next topic, which is the three reasons you should not use social media and the three reasons you should. Let's start knocking off the three reasons you should not.
Sure. So I work in social media for a living, which anyone that's heard me on here before kind of probably knows that. But it also I post about it on my blog because it relates to millennials and how churches understand, reach, and equip millennials. So I wrote this post last week, three reasons you should not use social media. I wrote it 2 weeks ago. And the three reasons are this. One, it can inflate your ego. Two, it can amplify your anger. And three, it can hurt your gospel witness. And really, those three points are pretty clear. And I think you've probably seen examples of this, and I've seen examples of this. But I think I think social media is a pretty neutral tool. I don't think it's wholly positive or wholly negative. I think, however, we are sinners. We're fallen. We're broken people. And because of that, we're going to use a very powerful tool like the internet, but especially a subset of the internet, social media, in potentially harmful ways a lot of the time, especially mm-hmm. if we're prone to sins like pride or prone to getting angry. All of us, because we're sinners, are prone to doing these things, but all of us are prone to certain things more than others, mm-hmm. My advice is like if you're prone to getting angry and kind of spouting off your mouth or being proud and wanting to show people how awesome you are all the time, you may want to stay away from social media entirely because mm-hmm. you're going to be faced with that temptation every time you log on.
Mm-hmm.
So the three reasons I think you shouldn't use social media are kind of go along with those temptations.
Very interesting. Now, social media approval can trigger the same chemicals in our brain that drugs and sex do.
Exactly.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah. There's a video posted by a guy named Simon Sinek, who is a well-known author and kind of like a business leadership field, but he does a lot of work on kind of how our brains work and how he's kind of like an armchair psychologist in a way, and explained how the same sort of chemicals that are released when we engage in some sort of drug where we just constantly want to be addicted to it can be the same when we get that red notification on Facebook or that notification on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be really careful about constantly seeking those things because we can kind of become reliant on those things. Yeah. And a number of years ago, I wrote about something called selective sharing, which like the life – it promotes this idea that this life we live online will not look like the life we're actually living in our everyday lives.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, we're going to take a break. When we come back, three reasons you should use social media. It's 46 after the hour. Be back in just a minute. Minutes after the hour, talking to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical, as I like to refer to him on occasion. And I'm going to talk about three reasons you should use social media in the marketplace of ideas. We can get some good ones out there, can't we?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a responsibility. You know, if you feel like you're able, or, you know, if you kind of think you're able to engage on social media without sinning constantly, as if that's able to be avoided. But if you think it's not going to be that much of a struggle for you to engage on social media without constantly telling people how awesome you are or constantly emitting your rage about whatever, I think it's really kind of a responsibility of Christians to engage wisely on social media. I think because it's kind of a neutral space, it really is a marketplace of ideas. And it's kind of like the 21st century town square. It's where we go to talk about stuff, everything from not important sports things or TV shows or whatever to really important things like politics or faith or whatever. And so I think it's important that if you're not going to avoid engaging for the sake of your own heart, that you engage wisely. And so I think there are three reasons you should use social media. One, it can help you serve others. Two, it can help you encourage others. And three, it can inspire you to action. Mm-hmm. So it can help you serve others because you're able to use the gifts God has given you to serve others. So like I really like writing and I really like looking at data or
– And watching baseball.
Studying.
Watching Cubs
baseball. Yeah, watching baseball, exactly.
Yeah.
Studying social media trends or studying religious trends. And so I want to use those interests and the gift that God's given me to be able to write to serve others. So that's why I started the blog in 2014, mm-hmm. To help people better understand millennials, because I feel like I kind of – you know, I was given this gift and this interest, so I should use that wisely.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it can help you encourage others. I think what Christians don't understand a lot of times is that – what a lot of people don't understand about the internet is that it's where nuance goes to die. The internet is so – not compatible with nuancing an argument or explaining an argument fully or explaining your stance or whatever. Like I used to get in Twitter battles about theological things, political things, etc. And then I just realized it's a completely futile fight, not just because you're going to not convince someone, but because the platform just isn't really built for that. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You end up misunderstanding each other or misrepresenting each other, not necessarily intentionally, but just because you don't have the characters to represent each other fully.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, thankfully, encouraging people on social media takes a lot less nuance. It takes virtually no nuance. You don't have to caveat encouragement. You know what I mean? And so I think social media is a great place to encourage others. Send a friend a message on Facebook or tweet at someone or engage with someone on Instagram. You know, whatever. It's a lot easier to have positive interactions on social media than mm-hmm. negative ones. And okay. It's better for everybody involved.
Yeah. Chris, I'm not on Facebook, so I have a lot of questions even about Facebook. Now, when you say send someone a message on Facebook, is that a message that just they receive or does everyone see it?
Sure. When I say send a message, I mean like a private message.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, you see a church friend who, you know, is going through a tough time and maybe you don't have their phone number, or, you know, they check their Facebook Messenger more than they check their text message or something. Send them a Facebook message and say you're praying for them, or say that you really enjoyed what they shared at small group the other day, or, you know, something like that.
Kind of a no-brainer,
thirdly,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, though, is I think we have so much pent up anger about stuff, whether it's just politics or world events or religious stuff or church issues or
that
family
is not
issues.
True. Oh, wait a second. Sorry, that came out
that
sideways.
That we feel like social media is the place to go online and spout that all off. And I think we need to remember that online interactions are not divorced from real life interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way that we, it's similar to what I wrote in the third point, of the reasons not to use social media, you can really hurt your gospel witness by acting inappropriately on social media. And I think Christians of all people should be making the internet a better place, the social spaces of the internet a better place. I think we should be using the social media platforms to encourage people and equip people with the gifts that we've been given, more than to promote ourselves or to provoke others to anger or whatever.
Chris, isn't it easy to marginalize people on social media? You're just looking for that one gotcha moment. Oh, he's one of those guys. Oh, done.
Of course.
I'm done.
Yeah.
I mean, so you talk about hurting your gospel witness. I mean, there's a way to just shut down the conversation instantly.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so easy. You know, credibility is a whole lot harder to build up than it is to lose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can spend years building credibility in a relationship with an unbelieving friend or neighbor that you happen to be connected with on Facebook. And then you post some borderline racist meme because it agrees with your political perspective or something on Facebook. And then you've just destroyed all the foundation of the relationship perhaps that you've built with that person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is really easy to, you know, like you said, play gotcha or just not even discourage others, but just wreck yourself in the eyes of other people.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've done stupid stuff on social media before that has made me look less mature or foolish in the eyes of others. And that's why no matter how important I think that issue may be, I think we need to realize that we might need to fight those battles, but we don't need to fight those battles on the social media battlefield.
True. And then it's good to maybe offer something of value if you do something well or you have some expertise, or, you know, if I wanted to give my meatloaf recipe, I could do that and people would be crazy about it. So, I mean, there are things to do that you can encourage people and give them something to look at and to enjoy.
I mean, I'm not even sure your amazing meatloaf recipe would get me eating meatloaf, but
I get it. I get it.
But you understand.
Yeah.
But I do think like that kind of goes back to my first point that social media can help you serve others. I mean, God has given you gifts. So if you love cooking and you're an amazing cook, film yourself doing some recipe in your kitchen and share it with your friends on how you made it or whatever. If you're really good at making music, post your music to SoundCloud and share that link on Facebook or Twitter with your friend. I mean, there are just all kinds of ways you can bless people through the platform and not just be angry all the time.
Right. Chris, it was fun having you on the program for the last time because no one makes fun of my meatloaf recipe. and I mean no one. Have a great weekend.
You too, man.
Talk to you in a couple weeks. 56 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break. Be right back. Minutes after the hour, we've had several listeners write in today commenting on the show. Tamara from Rogers just wrote us and said, great show today. So I want to say a special thanks to all the guests that came on the show and made it such a great show. We love having you on. And also, we had a great listener write in on the morning segment about how difficult it is to incorporate faith and work. And I'm going to try to look that over and process that a little bit. Maybe I'll share some of that on Monday coming up. 1 Peter 3:15, I get back to that. It says, but in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. That's a good way to leave it for today. Go out and have a great day and a great weekend. And remember that Sunday, we start with more time, more daylight. So set your alarm to get up at 2 in the morning so you can move your clock ahead. And then I'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone. God bless.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.